And Elizabeth tells me that some of you have been asking about past exam questions. You may know that last year the course wasn't given. I was on leave. So if you go to my website, you can see the course outlines for previous years, including the assessed essay questions. And I don't think I have the exam questions up there. I don't think so, but I have the assessed essay questions from previous years in which this course was taught. And I guess this is the third or fourth year this course is taught.
You can look at past exams by going to Jane Tyrrell, the main secretary in our department. These things are all on file, and they are available for public inspection, as far as I understand. Okay. Now, the question, of course, is whether it'll be worth your time. I would say that there is maybe a third to a half, being optimistic, overlap between what's going on now and what has gone on in the last version of the course. Okay? So, for example, stuff about expertise that I talked about in the first term, that was in the last version of the course. The last version of the course talked a lot more about the history of science than this version has done. You can see, I think the first thing for you to do is to go to my website, look at the course outline from the previous versions of the course, and make your own judgment. Make your own judgment about this. I mean, I'm happy to have you look at the past exams, and they're there for you to look at. But I don't actually look at past exams to come up with exam questions, in case you want to know that. I mean, so to me, each version of the course starts fresh. Okay? But you may get something out of it. There's nothing wrong with that. Is there some other reason why people are asking this question?
I don't know.
I don't know if the person who asked this question is in the room today, but you're perfectly... I mean, this is not the kind of course that does the same thing mechanically every year, perhaps the way some other courses do in the department, okay? It does change, you know, a fair amount. But there is overlap. Right? But I would say on the order of about a third. Okay, so, you know, you just take that. Now, we are going to have an exam review session in the third term, and I will announce that. I will send an email around. I don't know when it is yet. The exam date has not been set yet, has it? No. You would know if it had been. Okay, that typically happens at the beginning of the third term. And I might wait for that before setting the date. Okay? And there will be two exams given for those of you who are second years and those of you who are third years, because the class is basically equally split between those groups. So there will be two separate exams. But both exams will range over all the material in the course. So, for example, if you take a topic like feminism, right, which has been flagged as a topic for a lecture, you should assume that feminism will be of use to you in both exams. Okay. Other than that, I think just wait until we actually till I actually set the date, and then we'll have the full hour. I will basically give you the basic topics that will arise in the questions, and you will be allowed to ask me some questions about those, but I'm not going to give you the exact wording of the questions, but I can answer some general questions about what kinds of things might be worth preparing for. Okay? So, you'll just wait for that. Okay, now let me wrap up feminism today. The last time I ended by talking about the feminism's origins in Marxist approaches, at least if we think about feminism as a kind of universalist approach, right, to politics and the pursuit of knowledge more generally, right, that based on the fact that the majority of the population is female, but nevertheless has been in a subordinate position for most of history in almost all cultures, and nevertheless recognized as being instrumental for the reproduction of culture, not just biologically, of course, but in terms of managing the household and so forth. So women have played a very important role
but their contributions and their ways of knowing and being have not been properly acknowledged. And so there is this very strong strand in feminism that basically says that this balance has to be redressed, that that it is only once women are fully incorporated into both knowledge production and into politics that you can actually have a truly universal form of knowledge and truly democratic forms of politics. Okay. And the Marxist tradition provides a kind of template for understanding that through the vehicle of standpoint theory, which I pointed out last time. Marx, it's implied in Marx, but really only gets developed as a theoretical idea in Lukács, the Marxist theorist from the 1920s. Lukács wrote this book, History of Class Consciousness, where he develops the idea of the proletarian standpoint. Okay, and so there's meant to be an analogy between the working class and women. Now, I sent you last week this book review of Sandra Harding's book. Sandra Harding is the main standpoint feminist, and it is reviewed by an important guy in the American version of the Frankfurt School, Andrew Feinberg, who was a student of Herbert Marcuse, okay, and basically arguing about to what extent does this Marxist standpoint notion, can it be transferred over to feminism? And an interesting issue gets raised there, I think, and this is an issue that actually arises in the Marxist tradition as well, is, okay, let's say we do want to incorporate the proletariat, you know, and we want to incorporate women. Then what does the final product look like exactly? Right? What does the universal form of knowledge or the universal form of politics look like? Okay? I mean, you may know that that very often when people do the history of feminism, especially in the English-speaking world, there's always this tendency to go back to Mary Wollstonecraft. You've heard of her? Mary Wollstonecraft from the late 18th century. She was the wife of the anarchist philosopher William Godwin, she provided a lot of inspiration for what's called liberal feminism. And when we use the term liberal feminism, we usually mean the idea of establishing equality between men and women on men's terms, basically. Right? In other words, women can do men's jobs. Women are as smart as men. Women can do exactly the same kinds of things men can. And in a sense, it is just prejudice and a kind of social restrictions that prevent women from doing so. So women are as smart as men, but they're not allowed to go into public life. They're not allowed to go into the professions. And so as a result, they cannot achieve as much as men can. But within that perspective, and this was a perspective that was very strongly promoted by John Stuart Mill, who lived in the generation after Wollstonecraft. And in fact, you know, Mill, not only an important philosopher, but also a member of Parliament for the Liberal Party, representing Westminster in the 1850s and 60s, he was very much advocating extending the right to vote to women, you know, back then, okay, and wrote this very famous book on the subjection of women, which is a more systematic development of the kinds of ideas that Mary Wollstonecraft had been promoting. Now, that kind of way of looking at feminism, right, suggests that the whole goal of incorporating women into a universal project, you know, politics or science or whatever, in a sense wouldn't really change the ground rules in a sense, right? Science would sort of continue to go as it does, but it would have women in it now. And women would be shown and be allowed to succeed by the same standards that men in the past have succeeded by. Okay. So this kind of view of feminism really imagines that what the universal, you know, this universal kind of knowledge and politics that we're heading for is one that brings in everyone, but its overall point, its overall way of operating doesn't really change. So what's missing from liberal feminism in terms of more recent discussions of feminism? Well, in particular, what's missing from this picture is the idea that the stuff that historically women have done, managing the home, taking care of the kids, this kind of stuff, that's not really valued. Right, that is seen very much through the eyes of men, you might say. In other words, it's seen as the backroom stuff, as the stuff that's kind of, you know, has to be done, but doesn't have much value in the society. The real valuable things are being able to, you know, make speeches in Parliament and being able to mess around with test tubes in laboratories. Those are the important things of life. But taking care of kids, you know, that's kind of diminished work. And liberal feminism sort of, still keeps that view in mind, right? So that the measure of women actually being brought, you know, actually succeeding, actually being emancipated, being liberated, is that they're doing the things men do. Not that the things that women traditionally do get valued, but rather they're allowed to do what men do. Okay, I hope you see, I mean, that's a very important distinction, because that is one of the things that makes the whole politics of feminism, and also the epistemology of feminism, a very difficult kind of thing to sort out. Because we're getting very strong mixed messages here, right? I mean, from the 19th century liberal feminists, we're getting this idea of women are as good as men to do men's jobs. But the stuff that women traditionally do, that's not really very much value. However, what you start to get in the 20th century much more strongly, and this does come from a certain way of reading Marx, because Marx is kind of ambivalent on this point himself, is the idea that the very work that women have traditionally done is worth doing, but it needs to be valued more. So, for example, you know, you have to figure out the role of the household and householding activities in the political economy. You have to realize that these things involve a certain distinctive form of knowledge that cannot be captured by ordinary scientific, university-based knowledge, but is very distinctive, has its own principles, and needs to be respected as such. Okay, so you start to get this idea, there are women's ways of being, women's forms of knowledge, right, that have intrinsic value. And in fact, if you look at the role that it plays in the overall maintenance of society, may in fact be more important. Because without it, it all disappears. And so, in a sense, what's being asked for here in this kind of more radical, kind of affirmative view of what feminism is about, is, in a sense, men have to come to realize this. Right? In a sense, men have to realize that the ways they have been practicing science in the past, which privileges certain forms of knowledge, let's say based on physics and so forth, that only men have participated in, has in fact excluded, you know, enormous ways of knowing, enormous ways of being, that if they were incorporated, would change the character of science, and would change the character of politics. Okay? So, for example, when you get this kind of more radical vision of feminism operating in the political arena, right, typically what you start to get is a kind of problematization of the idea of the aggressive, agonistic character of politics, right? You think about what happens, you know, question time in Parliament and, you know, the way politics is conducted, generally very adversarial, very aggressive, everybody baring their teeth and, you know, everybody kind of being nasty to each other. And that is very masculine. Right, there's a sense in which if you're going to succeed at that, you in some sense have to adopt the masculine pose. Now, if you think about, for example, Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher, you know, she was called the Iron Lady when she was in office. Okay? And her manner was very much the kind, she had the kind of qualities that men usually have when they're regarded as good politicians. Very steely-eyed, very determined, talking people down, right, very authoritarian in that sort of way, right? She did not display the kinds of characteristics that would normally be associated with women's ways of being, like caring, nurturing, open, you know, this kind of thing. That was not her line at all. And whenever she tried to do that line, she failed miserably. It always looked very artificial. In fact, Tony Blair does it better, okay? And so, you see, this is the thing, that if you were to actually take seriously the idea that sort of women's ways of being and knowing the world would be incorporated in politics, you have a totally different style of politics. okay? And, you know, so for example, it would be, you know, the way in which people relate to each other. I mean, in the 1960s, when this kind of view of feminism, this very strong, you might say, ontological feminism, you know, feminism is a sort of distinctive way of being in the world, different from men. When this view first was promoted, there used to be this slogan around, I remember this when I was a child, that, you know, if women were in power, there'd be no wars. Right, you think about the 1960s with the Cold War and all these things going on, everybody's worried about the world being exploded in, you know, 2 minutes. And of course, why is this a problem? Because you got the world being run by a lot of old men. Okay? But imagine the world being run by young women. Okay? Then there wouldn't be any wars. It'd all be naturing, we'd be all growing flowers or whatever in the fields, you know, that sort of summer of love thing. But, you know, I mean, not to trivialize it, but the whole idea being that there's just a different way of orienting oneself to the world. And what's interesting about this kind of strong ontological position of feminism is that it basically says you can imagine a radical way of doing politics. That it need not be the way it has been conducted. There's a sense in which there's a gender anchor to politics. You know, not only, you know, politics is constrained by many things, right? For example, you know, if you look at the way in which the House of Commons is set up, and the way and the closeness of the people to each other, and so forth, that actually, that spatial characteristic of the way in which the House of Commons is laid out actually increases the intensity of the discussion. This is one thing sociologists who study space are able to detect, right? Whereas if you look at, I don't know if you've ever seen the United States Congress and how that's laid out. It's laid out in much more amphitheater style, kind of like the way you guys are, kind of spread out more. The European Union's the same way, if you ever look at the European Union, the way that the major assembly in Brussels. And it's all spread out, and people kind of, you know, and so there's distance between people. You know, people are much more isolated, and there's less of this kind of, this sort of intensity that comes from close proximity, right? So if you look at the front benches in the House of Commons, you see all these front, you know, these front benches all kind of, you know, shoulder to shoulder, as they say, you know, buttock to buttock, as they put it, you know, and that does add to the nature of the thing, okay? Well, just as there are these spatial constraints, there are also these gender constraints. The fact that it's men, and they're men talking over each other. And it's a very natural kind of thing to do. And all this, you know, derisive stuff, this heckling that goes on, okay? Very much public school kind of behavior, right? This kind of trying to sort of basically phase other people, make them, you know, uncomfortable and so forth. There is a, you know, there's a way of understanding where that kind of behavior comes from. It's nothing that you're taught about to do in politics. It's not like, you know, you take a course in politics and people say you behave that way. But rather, it's the forms of behavior you bring over into the political arena from the way you've been taught and the way you've been raised, and you happen to be the kind of person you are. So you're one of these privileged male guys, and that's the way you were at Eton. So you walk into the House of Commons and you just carry on. Okay? But women are trained differently, right? Women are under, you know, different constraints, different environments. The theory being that the women would function differently if there were enough of them there. Now, this is the interesting issue, because then the issue becomes, of course, as in the case of Margaret Thatcher, and as in the case of the women who are currently members of the House of Commons, that obviously there have been women who've succeeded by these so-called men's rules. And they can shout just as loud and stare down just as well as the men can. No doubt about it. Okay? But the question is, what does that show? What is proven by that? Is it show that women, you know, that there are certain women who actually can effectively turn themselves into men for social, from a sociological standpoint? In other words, they can, as it were, assume the role of a gender-anchored activity. They can pass for a man, in other words, because that's one way of reading what, you know, what Margaret Thatcher has done. She's done nothing for women. She just shows that women can turn themselves into men in the appropriate occasions. Okay, so that's one kind of view. Or the other view is, right, that in some sense, Margaret Thatcher is like the thin end of the wedge. That in a way, this kind of opens the door, as it were, to other women coming in. And once enough women come into politics, right, then the whole political way of being will change. You just need a kind of critical mass of women. Okay? Now, which hypothesis is true? basically. But there is a, you know, if you look at Scandinavia, where you do, in the Scandinavian countries, you do have large percentages of women occupying posts in the you know, congresses and houses of commons and so forth of those countries. It would be interesting if, you know, those of you who are thinking about a thesis topic or something someday, to look and see to what extent has the shift over to, a, let's say, in some cases, I believe, a majority of women in the political bodies, has that changed the dynamic of the politics? And to what extent? Okay? But it seems to me this is a kind of issue. Now, if you are concerned, if you do take a kind of a serious, if you take the ontological side of feminism seriously, namely that there is a certain kind of women's way of being in the world that is really different from men, and in fact men have to ought to be able to accommodate themselves to it at least as much as women have had to accommodate to men, okay, then you start to put a premium on the idea that maybe what institutions that don't have enough women in them at the moment need is affirmative action, right, or positive discrimination as it's called in this country. Okay. Right, the idea that you actually set up laws, you set up principles whereby you privilege women's entrance into fields that have been traditionally dominated by men. So, for example, I mean, this is a common, this has been a common practice in the United States now for 30, 40 years. Originally, it was thought about in the context of black people, but it applies to women as well. So, for example, in terms of university admissions. Okay, in the United States, as you know, universities have various standards for admitting students, and it may be that if they were to admit, you know, in very elite institutions that don't take in many students at all, that if they were to admit just, as it were, the top 20 people, they'd all be men. So, for example, what I'm thinking about here is a place like Massachusetts Institute of Technology, right, these very science-based universities, right, sort of like this is the equivalent, American equivalent to Imperial College, okay, where you can imagine that the back, you know, that if you were just top slicing the people who did best on the exam, you know, they'd be men. Okay, in those particular subjects. But you would say, well, no, for sociological reasons, for political reasons, we want to actually have a certain specific number of women there so that we can, in fact, encourage this kind of change in culture, that this is considered to be a social political value. And so then you admit women, right, you know, even if they score lower on these exams, right, to replace men who may have scored higher. Now, this has been led to an enormous number of court controversies, court cases in the United States. This is something that's actively subject to litigation, and some states have now repealed affirmative action as a result. Okay, because you get all these white guys, you know, who got replaced by women who got lower scores because of this. There's a lot of that, right? There's a lot of hostility and animosity and so forth. And it's true that once these women move into the male-based cultures, they're not necessarily given much help, right? So, okay, so these women get in through affirmative action, and the people there know it, who are men. And so that doesn't change anything. If anything, it makes life miserable for the women. Okay, and then that becomes a deeper question. How do you deal with the men who are already there in dealing with the women? Okay? Now, the idea here is, you know, there's a lot of issues going on here, right? One of them is this idea that actually women bring a distinctive kind of sensibility that could actually enhance the activities concerned, right? So in other words, if you were to, you know, bring women into politics more, if you bring women into science more, right, that the way in which these activities are conducted would change for the better. So you're sort of banking on that as the reason why you're pushing this affirmative action stuff. That's one thing. But the other thing, too, is the issue of prejudice of men. And where does the prejudice of men come from? Now, does the prejudice of men come from what very often they say, namely, the women aren't up to it? You know, you bring in these women artificially because you have these quotas, right, that are established by affirmative action, and, you know, you reap what you sow. Look what happens. They can't do the math, right, in the physics classes. They, you know, they don't do the experiments right. They don't work the long hours because they got to take care of children. You know, I mean, all this kind of stuff. That the women aren't up to it. Okay. Now, the question, you know, how do you judge that, you see? Is it, you know, and actually that's also one of these tricky areas that are open for sociological investigation. Is it just prejudice or is there something else going on? Now, generally speaking, I think most sociologists would say that there are structural conditions that are already present in the way in which science is done in particular that makes it very difficult for women to succeed. And this has nothing to do with intelligence. This has to do just with the kind of the work style of science. And so I just alluded to this business about, you know, when you're working on scientific experiments, right, if you think about the kind of people, you may know some of these people, these ultra-geek type people, right, who just spend all day, all night in the lab, they're eating in the lab, you know, they're doing everything in the lab, and now you can have computers in the lab, you never have to leave. And so you can monitor every little development that goes along if suddenly your test tubes start to get foamy or something, you know? Now the thing is, you know, very often women have other responsibilities outside of the lab. You know, they're raising children, they have family commitments with parents and things like this, with which men much more easily fob off, you know? Because it's much more normal for men to be seen as, I'm trying to establish my career, dear, you know, kind of thing. Mom, I'm sorry, I can't go to your funeral because I'm busy on an experiment. This is something men can get away with. Women can't get away with this, okay? And the thing is that the whole institution of science is structured in such a way that there's no kind of face-saving way out, right? So, you know, it's not, you know, and this is why it's only been in recent years, and after long struggle, that you actually, you know, that you get scientists being able to get maternity leave and being able to be, you know, out of their job to take care of kids for a certain amount of time and not lose the job altogether, right? But even then, even when they're granted that much kind of institutional space to be women, when they get back in to the science racket, they find they're so far behind because all the men who stayed in the lab had published all these papers and made all these advances. And so it becomes very difficult because the men don't change their lifestyles. The men are still geeking about in the lab while the women are given these leaves to do other things. Okay? And so if you think about this from an institutional standpoint, this is a really deep structural problem that isn't going to go away very easily. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, if one were kind of the great science czar, one would force men to have families. You know, force men to actually be involved in child rearing. You know, force men to leave the lab a little bit. But we don't do that. We haven't gotten to that stage yet. But in a sense, the empirical evidence with regard to women trying to cope in these traditionally male environments is such that really it's not enough just to allow women in and to, as you know, and to allow them to have the space they need to do the things they do, but rather men's behavior has to change, not only in terms of their treatment of women, but in terms of the way they conduct their own lives. Because if they carry on, right, as it were, the overall process of science is being led by the male lifestyle, by the guys who are publishing the most as fast as possible. Right? It's still happening. The only difference, as far as the women are concerned, is they're not being explicitly penalized in terms of losing their jobs. But it does make it difficult for them to succeed. Right? Because it becomes hard to catch up. Okay, so this is a really deep problem, I think. Really deep institutional problem that actually, if it were to be fully addressed, would involve restructuring men's lives. I really think that. I mean, because we see what, you know, on Monday, I gave a talk to the European Molecular Biology Lab in Heidelberg. And there were, you know, men and women in the audience and all this. So then we go to dinner afterwards. They're all men. At dinner. Okay, and they're all kind of young men, and they're all unattached. And so I made, you know, asked a question about, well, you know, about half the audience were women. So the talk was like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And why, you know, we just got a bunch of men here. I was kind of curious about this. Because this biology is one of the fields where women have been making some inroads that traditionally they've been locked out of. So there were women around, obviously women working here. Like, well, you know, the women have kids, they have family, and so forth. And these guys, you know, what they do, what they spend the night doing, they're either in the lab or they go down to the pub, you know. So having dinner with me is okay. Okay, it's a little bit better than what they would have had to do otherwise.
Right, whereas the women actually have real things to do. Okay? You see, and it seems to me this is like a little small version of this problem. Okay? And of course, one of the things that happens over these dinners, I don't know if you've ever gone to any of these academic dinners, but there's a lot of gossiping, of course, and basically, you know, people talk shop and, you know, figure out, you know, talk about what the latest trends are, who's up, who's down, where things are going, you know. And of course, from a career standpoint, you know, some of it is just bullshit, but from a career standpoint, some of that stuff actually gives you a lot of hints and clues as to how to orient yourself, you know, in a very competitive scientific market, right? All these informal events where people are, you know, kind of being open after a couple of drinks, those are very vital to be at, okay? And who are at these events? Men. Not the women. Women are home taking care of the kids. So they don't hear these kind of unofficial, informal stories that often, you know, providing you might say insider information that you could then use to advance your career. Okay, so see, these little things, right, they're very subtle things, they're very, the things, you know, that you don't think about very much, but from a structural standpoint, reinforces, right, gender dominance. Okay, and it's not because anyone is putting down women. Right? You know, all these things I've just talked to you, there was never a moment where any of these males say, oh, this woman's a wuss because she's taking care of kids. No, they actually talk about it like, you know, that's a reasonable thing to do. Yeah, that still doesn't stop this process from happening. That doesn't stop them from not being around when all the trade secrets are being shared. So big deal that the guys aren't appalled that the women are taking care of kids. That's a very small gain as far as, you know, gender politics is concerned. Okay? So this is a real deep issue. This is a real deep issue. And it's not exactly clear how it's going to be solved. Now, in practice, the way it is being solved is basically you have a large percentage of women, especially in the first world countries, just not having families. You know, by whatever means, you know, deliberately or not, they are adopting more male-like lifestyles. That is pretty much what's been happening. And so insofar, you know, as, you know, one wants to give a kind of optimistic overall picture about women's progress in something like science, and I think the same would be true in politics, that it's the product of women, you know, basically not feeling the kind of pressure they had in the past to immediately get married and start a family and stuff like that, and rather they can take a male lifestyle. And that's perfectly acceptable. I don't know if you read The Guardian. I read The Guardian this morning, and it has a big kind of main article on cities. And it was really interesting. They were talking about Berlin and said something like whatever 58% of women or something live in single accommodations. Okay, that's a pretty interesting fact right there. Okay, you know, it seems to me that this is kind of the way this problem is kind of sorting itself out without much concerted action. Namely, more and more women are adopting male lifestyles. And then they're able to succeed by the male rules. And now, here's the thing that makes all this very even more complicated than it already is. And that's the fact of what women's attitudes toward this is. So far, I've been talking about this as, you know, kind of the divine sociologist standing above the thing, you know, and basically talking about the trends and saying, well, look, if we're really concerned about women making their way through these traditionally male-dominated systems because we believe that women have a very kind of distinctive way of understanding things that ought to be represented in those activities, then we have a lot of institutional problems that need to be addressed. So that's me speaking as the divine sociologist standing above it all. But supposing you ask women about this, okay, and what they think about this, especially the women who've succeeded, okay, the women who've succeeded and the women who aren't succeeding, they don't hold this view. This is an interesting thing, and this is the big problem. There isn't this kind of sisterhood stuff that the feminist theorists like to talk about, right? Sisterhood doesn't exist when you succeed, basically. It's, you know, it exists when you're in the outside. It doesn't exist when you're in the inside.
And so one of the things that you find, especially among very successful women in science, not just politics, I'm not just talking about Margaret Thatcher here, but is, you know, to varying degrees, right, a reluctance to give up the traditional standards by which people are judged in the fields. You know, in other words, you know, if I managed to succeed by the male rules, even though I was a woman, then other people should be able to have to do the same thing. That's a very common view, because they sort of take their own success as in some way indicative of the fact that the rules aren't really gender biased. That maybe particular individual men are gender biased, right, who are prejudiced in various ways, right? So in other words, they do acknowledge there's gender bias, but it's not structural, it's not institutional. It's just particular guys that you have to deal with. And then you get beyond them, and if you've got enough, you know, talent and perseverance, you'll succeed at the end. This is the view that you get from the women who manage to make it in the system. Again, another interesting dissertation project one day would be for people to interview female sociologists, of which we've got a lot in our department. Our department's full of women sociologists, not, you know, including professors. And it would be interesting to interview them on these issues and what they think about whether there's gender bias, and to what extent there's gender bias, whether it's structural, institutional, or merely at the personal level. Okay? Because my guess is that even in this field, which in a sense is the most self-conscious and sensitive of all these gender issues, that you will find that successful women will be very reluctant to take a very hard line about saying you need to do radical institutional structural change for women to succeed. I think you may find some, you will find some, but I think you will not find as many as you might think. Okay? And I think this is a real tricky issue here. So when it comes to something like feminism, because look, there is, if you look at this overall picture, let's say, from the time that feminism becomes a really self-recognized political movement in the 1960s, there is a general overall trend of women doing better. You know, they're getting more jobs and things. I mean, that is happening. It's not happening as fast as one might like. The differences in the income between men and women are not, you know, narrowing as much as one might like, and in some respects are growing broader. But if you look at the long trend, things are improving. Okay? Now see, this is the problem, because the more and more things improve, even if only at this incremental pace, right, then you have, in effect, more and more women who can present themselves as having been successful within the system. Okay? And that actually makes it then very difficult for feminism as a kind of overarching emancipatory movement that ideally would want a radical transformation of the institutions by which knowledge and power are reproduced in society, right? Right? That movement, it becomes hard to sustain that. Because basically you've got too many successful women. Right? And the successful women sort of say, well look, you know, all we needed to do was to get rid of those older generation males who sort of never got the point of women anyway, right, get rid of those dinosaurs, and then women can make their way through the system as it more or less is normally constituted. Okay, so you're getting more and more women thinking like this, and this is one of the reasons why feminism, as a powerful political movement, is losing steam. Is this. Okay? It has nothing to do with, you know, men resisting women and stuff like that. Men are always resisting women. Right? I mean, in a sense, there was more resistance to women in the 1960s, but actually motivated the movement. Okay? And certainly in the 19th century and prior centuries when there was, you know, feminist things, right? It wasn't that men were saying, oh yeah, that's a great idea. No, they were always resisted. You know, that's not going to go away. Okay? But the interesting thing is when the women themselves feel motivated to do something. And the problem is that the more and more women who succeed by more or less the traditional rules, the harder it becomes to make the very big argument that
you know, we need to radically transform our institutional structures in order to represent women fully. You know, and so, you know, when we talk about things like, you know, backlash of women against feminism, you know, this kind of stuff, that's kind of where that comes from. It doesn't come from these women thinking that feminism is kind of wrong in principle, but rather they think that, you know, feminism in it, to a certain extent, has succeeded and is succeeding on this modest scale, and that's really about as far as it can be expected to do, so that you have to just, like, wait over time. Okay? And that the more radical feminists are kind of like the more radical Marxists who say, right, that, you know, that people will not be emancipated until everyone's incomes are roughly equal. Right? And everyone's got, you know, enough to eat and security and so forth, and until that time, we're subjugated. Right? And the more radical feminists sound a bit like that. But if you look and say, well, people are improving their situation. It's not perfect, but it's getting better. Then why do you need some overarching movement? Especially given that, of course, feminism is polarizing. It's consolidating, but it's also polarizing. So, for example, to call oneself a feminist, okay? I don't know. You know, especially the women in the audience here. I mean, if you, you know, you go and talk to your, you know, talk to someone you know, and someone asks you just off the cuff, are you a feminist? Doesn't that give you a bit of a shiver up your spine to have to give an answer? I mean, that seems to me much more so than a generation ago. A generation ago, people wouldn't have any problem. Sure, I'm a feminist. I believe in you. Nowadays, women don't, aren't so, you know, feminist. You know, they'll qualify and hedge and, you know, and say, well, you know, I'm not one of those radical militant feminists. I do believe women ought to be treated equally. In other words, they start to talk like liberal men. Right? Because, you know, that's kind of the answer men normally give when they're asked whether they're feminists, and women are beginning to sound the same. Okay? So there's at least that equality of rhetoric that seems to have been established. But what you don't get is you don't get, you know, women immediately embracing the term. You say, yeah, I'm a feminist. Right? And so, it seems to me this is a shift that's happened, but it's a, you know, it's kind of, this is, by the way, something that, this phenomena that I'm talking about here, where in a sense, you know, feminism has a certain kind of modest degree of incremental success over time, and then people kind of backing away from the movement. This is not just unique to feminism, okay? I wasn't intending to talk about this, but this is a very interesting general kind of political phenomena that a political sociologist who was a student of Max Weber's pointed out in about 1920. I don't know if you've ever run across this man. Roberto Michels. He wrote a book called Political Parties. Okay? What this book is about the history of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. So he's a student of Max Weber's. What he talks about is this, you may know this expression, he's the one who's responsible for this term, co-optation, i.e. selling out, right, where you somehow, you get incorporated, you get assimilated, and so you lose what's distinctive about you, because, you know, so in other words, you know, you start off as this kind of radical minority movement with a very distinctive program, platform, and so forth. You know, you want to radically transform the world, you want to overturn the structure, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, you get a little taste of power. You get brought into a coalition government. And so you're allowed to do a couple of the things you want to do. And then, that's the thin end of the wedge. Because you get more electoral success this way, you see. So as you moderate your views a little bit, you get more votes, and you get into more governments, and at some point you can become the dominant party in the country. But by that time, you've sold all your ideals down the river. Sounds a bit like Tony Blair. I mean, and this is co-optation. Right? And basically, the history of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, from the time of Bismarck, with the unification of Germany in 1870, until the outbreak of World War I, that's the period that he's talking about. He's looking at the history of the Social Democratic Party, which starts off as this very explicitly Marxist party that barely is allowed to function in Germany,
you know, violence, because as we know, there was a lot of violence and so forth that the Marxists were perpetrating. They relinquish violence. They say they will operate purely within constitutional means. And they start off as a minority party on the far left. And then over time, because Germany has a very fragmented party system, they gradually gain adherence, and various leaders start cutting deals with other parties at the center, and they get into government, and they start, and what Michel shows is the more and more they succeed. So at the outbreak of World War I, they're the dominant party in Germany. Okay, so 1940, they're the dominant party. Okay. But they have sold out all their Marxism by the end of that. Okay, I mean, it's like the New Labour story. It really is. I mean, if you read Michel's, it's kind of like the, from old Labour to New Labour. It's exactly that story. It's the German Social Democratic Party. Okay, co-optation. So it is this kind of, you become a victim of your own success, you might say. Because you might think, because the original thinking before this kind of phenomenon was noticed was to say, well, you know, if a radical party gets any kind of taste of power, right, then they'll just want to kind of impose their views on everybody, right? They'll just want to take over the whole show. You know, so in other words, if you were to let a radical in just a little bit, they would destroy everything. But no, what this shows is, no, you let the radical in a little bit, and he'll sell out immediately. Okay? You know, because power is what... Michel's punchline, this is where Michel shows himself to be a student of Max Weber, right? Politics is about power. Getting it and maintaining it. This is Max Weber's view, right? I mean, it's a kind of a, you know, Max Weber has this kind of view that, in a sense, you know, if you had to identify the ontology of power, what is the stuff of power? I mean, excuse me, what's the stuff of politics? The answer is power. And what the difference between, you know, authoritarianism and democracy and all these different political formations is just the way the power is arranged. And I think, you know, you got to imagine that Weber's thinking about power kind of like physicists back then in the turn of the century would have thought about energy, right? And energy can be molded and channeled in different ways, and that's how you get the differences in the political systems that exist. But at the end of the day, it's about power. Whether we're talking democracy, or we're talking about, you know, monarchy, or whatever, it's power. And Michel's basically shows that the co-optation of the Social Democratic Party to become the party of power shows that, right? Because they sell all their ideals. From radically wanting to radically transform the society, they become the establishment. Okay? Now, the question... Now, see, this is the thing that's happening to feminism. If you think about the success of women, the gradual success of women, it's happening at a much slower rate, I think, than this kind of issue here with the Social Democratic Party. But I think this is the thing, that in a sense, the spirit and the soul of feminism is gradually dissipating as more and more women get incorporated into the already existing institutions and power structures. Because then it becomes easier and easier to say, yes, we can accomplish our goals by the existing means. We don't need to radically transform things because, look, we're already inside. And it just, in a matter of time, we'll bring the rest of you inside. But it never happens. It never happens. And of course, one of the reasons why, I mean, the irony of it all is, of course, one of the reasons why Lenin, right, who's kind of floating around Europe during the latter part of this period, one of the things that really motivates him to want to start a real violent revolution in Russia is looking at what happens to Germany. Because remember, Marx said the revolution was going to happen in Germany because it had the largest and most organized labor movement in Europe. But then Lenin sees that these Marxists just sell themselves out once they get assimilated into government a little bit, once they get a little bit of their way. And so Lenin says, we're not going to allow this to happen. And that's why if you look at the Russian Revolution, and you look at the attitude toward the Mensheviks, right, who were the people who were like the social democrats of Russia after the fall of the Tsar, right? Lenin and all the people on that side of the Marxist tradition, the revolutionary Marxist tradition, have utter contempt for those people. Even though if you look at what the Mensheviks stood for, the social democrats, they, you know, nice guys kind of people, right? But they are seen as having sold out. They are seen as having gone down this route of co-optation. And so, in order to keep the sort of original, pure vision of Marxism, You've just got to fully break with the system. Right? You have to start the institutions from scratch because assimilation and incorporation is never going to work. That's Lenin's logic, okay? That's Lenin's logic of revolutionary Marxism. Now, the thing is, is there some, feminist equivalent of Lenin? I don't think so. Okay? But without that, and I don't think it's going to happen, right, I think you're going to end up, feminism is going to lose its steam, just like the Marxists did under parliamentary government and become, a weaker kind of, mildly progressive sort of movement as more and more women get brought in, but that the fundamental institutions and the ideas governing them may not change. I'm just proposing this as a hypothesis to you. I hope this doesn't happen. But it seems to me, if, again, taking my position as a divine sociologist, looking at all this stuff, where history is going, I don't see, a feminist version of Lenin out there that's going to reassert the strong feminist ideal. But that's really what you would need for the ideal to be realized. Okay. Okay. Well, so I'll end there. I was going to summarize the course for you, but you've been here already, so. I certainly am not going to do it in the fortune cookie. So I will give you. I will send you an email about when we're going to have this exam session. Have a look at the previous course outlines and look at the past exams if you want. I'm happy to have you do so. Jane Tyrrell is the person who you contact for that. And good luck. Have a good holiday. Whatever.
If you haven't been at the seminar on Monday, then please take an evaluation questionnaire and fill it in and return it to Jane Cooper, please. Okay?